This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious, sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. I tried this recently after hearing about it on another podcast, and since then, I've stocked up on boxes and boxes of this and usually use it 1 to 2 times per day. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks. As a coach or an athlete, you will not find a better product that focuses on the essential electrolytes your body needs during competition. Element has become a staple in my own training and something we are excited to offer our coaches and student athletes as well. Element is used by military special forces teams, Team USA weightlifting, at least 5 NFL teams, and more than half the NBA. You can try it risk-free. If you don't like it, Element will give you your money back, no questions asked. They have extremely low return rates. Element came up with a very special offer for you as a listener to this podcast. For a limited time, you can claim a free Element sample pack. You only cover the cost of shipping. For U.S. customers, this means that you can receive an 8-count sample pack for only $5. Simply go to drinkelement.com/Justin Climo. That's drinkelement.com/Justin Climo to claim your free 8-count sample pack. drinkelement.com/Justin Climo.
The Context Podcast is proudly sponsored by Delta Wines and Brick and Mortar, our everyday go-to with sustainability built in. Delta Wines are vibrant yet balanced, made to be enjoyed on special occasions. Brick and Mortar was founded in 2011 and has worked to create the European wine drinker's California wine. The wines are small lot, single vineyard sourced from Napa, Sonoma County, and Mendocino Ridge. In addition to tasting good, they also help you feel good with an eco-friendly packaging and environmental nonprofit donations with every purchase. Buy online at winesforchange.com. Also, use the code CONTACTS to support us and get a discount. The presentation is beautiful, the wines are great, and you'll be supporting saving the earth. What more do you need? Again, that's online at winesforchange.com. Discount code CONTACTS at checkout.
Hello, and welcome to CONTACTS, a podcast dedicated to bringing you practical ideas from coaches sharing what they have learned throughout their career. I want to open the door into my network of contacts whose innovative, reflective, and diverse coaching knowledge may offer ideas to enhance your experience. I'm your host, Justin Climo.
Welcome back to Contacts. We are joined today by Andrew Vasher, head men's basketball coach for the last 16 years at Hartnell College here in Salinas. Coach, really excited to have you on. Can't wait to learn a few things from you.
I'm excited to be on with you today, Justin.
Well, let's dive right in. Take us through your background as a coach. How did you end up in this profession? And what was the process like for you landing your first job and any transitions you've made since then?
Back when I was about a sophomore in high school, I realized I wasn't going to make the MBA. And we had a very impactful high school coach who actually lived right behind us. And during that time, there was a show on TV called The White Shadow. And I just thought, wow, you wouldn't ever have to work if you did that for a living. So that's when I started to want to be a coach. I went on and played at 2 different schools, Lewis Clark State, the baseball school up in Idaho, and then Eastern Arizona Junior College. Then I went on a 2-year mission for our church where I was in New York City. And then when I came back, I got married. And then decided I wanted to go serve in the military. So I was in the Army for 2 years at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the guys that jump out of helicopters. And when I got out of there, I went to school at Northern Arizona University. And when we first got on campus, I went to the Sky Dome where the basketball team practices. And my former JC assistant coach was now an assistant coach at NAU. And I went down and said, I want to be a coach. I've been on a mission for 2 years. I've been in the military for 2 years. Can I just come to practice every day? I'll sweep the floors. I'll pick up towels. I'll do anything. And what happened was the old part-time assistant that only made $12,000 a year had left. So within a month and a half, I became the part-time assistant as an undergrad at Northern Arizona University, and unbelievable experience. So I was very fortunate. I finished my degree. I worked with them a little longer. The head coach got let go. The new one came in, didn't have the same values and those type of things. He wasn't a bad guy at all. We just were different. He said I could stay on, but by that time we had three little kids. So I took a high school job out on the Navajo reservation, which was an unbelievable experience. We did that for a year. And then I took a different high school job in Arizona, and I was there for 6 years in a place called Snowflake up in the mountains. And then I left there. During that time, we had another child. So we had four kids, and my wife was staying at home. She just graduated from nursing school. So I quit my job to become a Division II assistant, which you actually got paid, but not really, at Adams State University in Colorado. And from there, we did that for 1 year. And then I came back to the local JC that was right where I was coaching high school. They created a full-time position for me. I went and did that. And this is how I got to Columbia. It was like the first day of school, and we got a call from the former coach. I won't say his name. The former coach at Columbia, who was good friends with my head coach, and said, "Hey, Richard, I just got the job at Ventura. I'm headed down south on I-5. Do you know of any players?" So I quickly got on the phone with the AD at Columbia and said, "Rumor has it, you guys might be looking for a new head coach." And he says, "That would be news to me, but since it's the first day of school and he's not here, that very well could be the case." So within 2 weeks, I got hired halfway through the third week of school. So there were no players there. There was a couple red shirts, and Matt Williams was the only one returning. So I had about a week and a half to get my team in place. We started out 1-12, and then we lost in the regional championship. So the second half of the year, we turned things around, and we lost a lot of close games early. And then we beat the first place ranked team in the state, the third, and then we went on a run through the playoffs where we beat almost everybody who was highly ranked. So I was there for 6 years. I think my last 4 years there, we may have won more games than anybody in the state, but it was always a program that we were the only sport and wasn't a lot of funding. They were always threatening to close it down. When this one came up, we moved to Saline. Division I assistant, Division II assistant, JC head coach, high school coach. I was a Division I guy, then became a high school coach. And some of the best coaches I ever coached against were those high school coaches in Northern Arizona.
Yeah, that is such a fascinating journey. I'm over here taking notes, and you've done everything on the face of the planet. And so I'm trying to figure out where I want to go next on this thing. And what I usually ask is, what are the things you still needed to figure out when you took over as a head coach? But I'd love to hear that in a quick soundbite. But what I'm really interested in is the comparison of what it's like to coach on a reservation and what lessons you were able to learn there and adapt your approach coming from college to predominantly an underserved
rural community. Yeah. And have you seen that thing on Netflix about the Navajos? Absolutely. I coached against him. I coached against Raul Mendoza when he was at Holbrook High School. And he was there forever before he went out to Chinle. So Raul was a good friend of mine. And that was really very accurate of what it was like out there. We were really young. Our kids were like 3, 2, and 1 at that time. And you're out on the reservation. So when my wife would come to all the away games, we were probably the only Anglos in these 4,000 seat arenas, right, jam-packed full. And the thing I love about the Navajos is I can drive through Flagstaff now, and that's 25 years later, or almost 30 years later, and I might see someone who'll say, "Hey, Coach Basher, how are you?" I was at Disneyland probably 8 or 9 years ago, and one of my players that played for me at Ganado saw me waiting in a line. Now, at that time, he was about 6'3", and like 155 pounds in high school. Now he's about 220. So it's hard to recognize him, but it was an unbelievable experience. And they always told with Native Americans, with Navajos, you can't look them in the eye. You can't do this. And I said, That might be true with the older, more traditional ones, but these were just high school kids. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We treated them like any other high school kid, and we were only there a year, mm-hmm. but it was a great experience.
Yeah, so if I could go back a little bit and then reframe the question, and obviously you've had a ton of stops, so I don't want you to have to go through that, but in your first job, and you've been on a 2-year mission, so you knew how to network with people, you knew how to meet people, you've been in the Army, you became an assistant coach, so you thought you had good footing. As you land as a head coach, what did you realize that you needed to figure out? And then as you've gone along that journey from place to place, what is maybe the one thing that jumped out at you of each of those stops that was different enough that it set with you through that time?
When I was at NAU, you got to meet. And when I played, you just meet different coaches and you play how they play. And each guy I played for in college was different. And then when I went to NAU, he was different. And that was right when the flex was being a huge thing, which is probably the worst offense ever. So when I became a head coach, I had to figure out, how am I going to play? How am I going to defend? When I played in high school, Bobby Knight is 76. And, you know, let's play defense. That's how we played defense. And then we played in a very Anglo league with a bunch of big white kids in it. And we're a bunch of small Navajos. So we played probably more zone than I'd ever thought I would ever play. We just adapted. That was the biggest thing. But how do you rotate people through? How do you have a practice? And we'd always have to be done at a certain time in Ganado because they had to take an hour ride, bus ride home. So you had to be done, and they would have these huge long bus rides to get back to where they live. Mm-hmm. But that was the biggest thing. How am I going to decide how to play?
And how is that carried with you at your subsequent head coaching stops? So at Columbia, at Hartnell, how have you encountered similar situations?
My next high school job, I was at Snowflake High School, and we lost in the state championship my first year to a team in our league. We beat them. They lost in the semis, so we didn't lose them. But that was Raul Mendoza from that Chin League presentation. And he played the Dick Bennett on the line, up the line type of stuff back when Dick Bennett did that. And he was a big Don Meyer guy. Mm-hmm. And this was when Don Meyer was making all the videos. So I called up Coach Meyer and said, can I talk to you about what you do? And he goes, just come work my camp. So for about 5 summers, I drove from Arizona out to Nashville and worked Coach Meyer's camp for 3 weeks every year. And he'd just yell, hey, Snowflake, because that's what high school I was from. And it was about Coach Meyer is years later, when after he'd had his leg amputated and he was talking at the Nike clinic, I went with my 2 boys. And they grew up listening to his tapes the whole time. And we walked up and he goes, hey, Snowflake, what are you doing here? And he had a huge impact mm-hmm. on me in my whole life mm-hmm. and how we did everything at Snowflake and then how we did things at Columbia. And we still did that here. I'd say one of the biggest changes was we were always a big Roy Williams, Dean Smith, Don Meyer, Carolina break. But when the shot clock went from 35 to 30, I think we changed a lot of things mm-hmm. because the Carolina break just put us so deep mm-hmm. into the shot clock. It just felt like we weren't able to do much other than a ball screen mm-hmm. and a shot after that. Mm-hmm. So we adapted more to the Lenny Acuff's a big friend of mine who was at UAH Huntsville forever mm-hmm. and they run an up-tempo Princeton beeline type of things. Mike Maker when he was at Williams did a lot of that, so we do a lot of that stuff now mm-hmm. and really teach our kids how to play in any given situation.
So it was more about realizing that the X's and O's matter, but knowing your personnel and understanding who you're playing against and realizing that you may have to shift from what you thought you knew to what the current moment calls for.
Yeah, just kind of adapting to our situations and really trying to teach our players to figure out what they do well mm-hmm. and have them focus on becoming elite at those specific things more than being mediocre in a lot of different things.
Yeah, so let's go in on that. There's 2 schools of thought there, right? Let's develop everybody's weakness, or let's just name your strength and allow athletes to go be great at that and then build the team in that way. Were you always that way, or was that a shift throughout your career that led you to focus on that approach?
I think we still kind of try to teach the base fundamentals, but I think it's a mindset we want our players to really focus on. Quit trying to do things you can't do. Mm-hmm. Really zero in on what you do well. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that more often, you're going to find more opportunities to play. And if you're not a great shooter, know who the great shooters are and make sure you find a way to get them the ball in an open situation.
Yeah, no, I think that where I wrestle with it is there's the school of thought that when you do that, you're limiting people. And I got to a point early in my career because of being able to ask some mentors that were around who were highly successful. And Ron McKenna, who was longtime Kennedy High School coach, they pounded us. And after the game, I asked him a question. He's like, look, coach, I have no problem telling kids what they can and can't do. And as a 24-year-old, I was like, oh, interesting. And I've gone to the lengths of what you just described. It's, hey, this is what you're good at. Let's go be great at this. And the off season, we can develop these things, but now's not the time to try that. You're not showing up to the tee box if you can't hit the driver in the fairway thinking that all of a sudden you're going to hit it in the fairway.
Exactly. Ben McCallum, the D2 coach at Northwest Missouri State, has a couple talks on that. And he really goes into focusing in what they do well and becoming elite at that. And he goes, it changed the way your kids look at themselves. Instead of being mediocre, I am phenomenal at setting screens and slipping. It changes their outlook. You're looking at them as a solid contributor, an elite player, instead of a guy that can't do something. And he goes, their whole attitude changes when you start finding them doing great things instead of telling them in front of everybody the things they can't do.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's the balance, right? How do you this versus no, you can't do this. And here's why. It's a delicate balance, but it's one that when walked well, really leads to having a jump in success of your teams. On that note, I'm sitting here curious about what you would say is the best thing you do in your program. And by that, are there things that are non-negotiables that you've taken from spot to spot that has the largest ripple effect on your culture? Maybe you saw somebody else do it. Maybe in a conversation, coach said, hey, I just started doing this and it's been transformational. What would you say that is for the Panthers?
I would say our biggest thing, and this sounds corny and hokey, but our biggest thing is we want to add real value to our kids' lives. And that is far reaching. And we want them to have that same type of thing. We want to get to know them. We want them to gain that trust. We want them to know that we are there as their advocate and support. And as we do that, then all the basketball stuff just falls in place. Now, basketball-wise, we are a big pass and cut. And we don't run the Princeton, but we run Princeton concepts. So we run a lot of two-guard concepts that I think have really helped. Because we don't look like a JC team. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of high academic guys that are playing JC because they're good enough to get into any school in the country, but they weren't recruited by those type of schools mm-hmm. and they want to keep playing. Mm-hmm. So we have some really smart guys.
Got it. Are there things specifically that you use to add value to these kids' lives?
We make them do a whole lot of community service. They don't keep track in the state, but we've averaged over 750 hours just from our team and our coaching staff, each of about the last 14 or 15 years. Wow. And we would like our guys to be involved in something 1 hour a week or an hour every other week. And a lot of our guys have done stuff with Gil in his academies. We're not big into go pick up garbage on the side of the road. Now that's important, but we wanted them to interact with people in uncomfortable situations. We do elementary reading. We've had 1 year, one guy would go to the retirement home and play cards once a week or every other week. We get in some big projects. We an interfaith alliance where we handed out, I think, close to 1,500 turkeys at Thanksgiving every year for the last decade. And we do that. We try to get some community people involved. Some of our bigger projects, we had the CFO from Tanamere and Antle. We had a construction company head, because that teaches our guys. These guys are doing it not because I'm making them. They're doing it because it makes their life better. And that tells more to our kids than anything we could say. And it also tells the community what our program's all about more than anything I can say when they see the kind of guys we have and what we do.
Fascinating. Like, I love that. So I want to know a couple things. And one of them is, in a community college environment, you're usually in a situation where you have a lot of interaction with the coaches of the other sports, especially if they're all full-time faculty members, right? Yeah. Like you are. And what I'm curious about is, as a basketball coach, how have you taken advantage of that network of colleagues and borrowed from things you've seen them do or discussed ways in which you've found success that have then maybe shown up on a swim team or whatever other sport? But this transmutation of, hey, I don't just have to learn from basketball coaches. This is what I've gotten by these colleagues I work with, and it's really made a big difference in what we do.
I think our soccer team is great. And Daniel Ortega's the men's coach. He's been here almost the whole time I've been here. And I don't know anything about soccer, okay? But according to him, spacing is huge in soccer. And spacing is huge for us. And we've talked about how you keep things in our terminology would be our pack line defense. Mm-hmm. And they have those same type of concepts in soccer. So it's interesting to see how the terminology that they use and how they get that across to their kids. And I don't know if we changed anything, but it helped us teach it in a different way to help our kids understand that. And that we've probably done most more with them. And I talked to Coach Babin quite a bit, the baseball coach, just about team building things more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like that. The idea of space, obviously, in basketball, my good friend always tells me, look, basketball is not that complicated. On offense, you're trying to create space. On defense, you're trying to take it away. And to hear the soccer coach explain things the same way just goes to show that your network of mentors isn't limited by your sport, especially in a place like yours where you have somebody right next to you. No. I also wonder, because your background is so unique, if, and maybe you haven't even thought about it this way, but I'm going to ask a super random question. Are there things that you can point to from your missionary work and your time in the Army that have informed or have bled into your approach to coaching that you can point to specifically?
I would think being on a mission, and I didn't grow up a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I joined during my college years. And then a year later, I left on a mission. And it just grounded what was really important to me. And then when I came home, I thought it was important. Now I serve God. Now I need to serve our country. So I went in the Army. And I just think, really focusing on what's really important to you. And as I coach, what needs to really be important to them. Coach Meyer had such an impact on me. And he always said, winning's great. And you can win all you want. And he wasn't a big Billy Tubbs fan. But he goes, like, Tubbs wins like crazy. But what does his program stand for? And he goes, well, I'm not going to tell you because I'm a Christian man. But I said, okay, Don. But he goes, if you're going to have a truly championship program, it needs to stand for something more than just winning and losing and just basketball. And I think those experiences and going out to Tennessee with Coach Meyer has really impacted me on what I thought was important and what our program needs to stand for.
Great answer. How would you say your approach to coaching has changed over the years? You start off at NAU as an assistant, you're on a Navajo reservation, you're a high school guy, you're a D2 guy, you're a D1 guy, you're a community college guy. How would you say your approach over that long arc of a career has changed?
I think early, when I was 24 or 22, I was a D1 guy when I was just off my mission out of the Army. So I was 23. And you're really big into X's and O's and doing all this, and this is how we're going to do it. And as you grew up, but gained more experience, you really started to understand that you weren't coaching X and O's, you were coaching people. Mm-hmm. And you had to learn how to build those relationships. And when you were really young, when I was a high school coach, I was, 7 or 8 years older than they were. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't that much difference. So how you related to him and might have changed a little bit now as a guy with 12 grandkids. I had four sons play for me. That was different. And one was an All-American and one played and one didn't play at all. And one redshirted for a year before he left on his missions. And I had two on the team at the same time, which is the toughest thing I ever had to do. So, cause one played a lot and one didn't. But I think as the longer I've done it, you've realized you need to get to know your kids in a way that you can help them. Yeah. And I think with, at our level with college aged kids, I think one of the most important thing is helping them understand not what's important to me, but for them to figure out what's important to them. Because you know, in college anymore, it just seems like all your professors are trying to ingrain in you what they think is important. Mm-hmm. And college is about time for them to figure out what's important. Mm-hmm. And for their values to be challenged a little bit so they figure out what it really is, not just conform. So I think that's kind of adapted. I don't think I'm a hollerer, but I'm enthusiastic. I make our guys run if they swear. And if I swear, I have to run 4 miles. If they have to run, they have to run like a 17 in a minute. And believe me, when I went to Columbia and I had a bunch of kids from Oakland on our team, we ran a lot those first week, but they stopped. So you really, it's back to Coach Meyer. You get what you tolerate.
Absolutely. 100%. And that your comment, I have a lot of enthusiasm. It sounds like Forkham. I give a lot of verbal encouragement, which is hilarious.
My son played for Chris Beard.
Okay.
Who's at Texas Tech now. My son played for him at Angelo State. And Chris is intense and supportive and loud. Mm-hmm. And I've played for a guy who wasn't. He was just loud. He was yelling at you, not to you. And I think there's a huge difference.
Yeah, for
you're
sure.
Yelling at the crowd so the crowd knows it's not my fault. Right. It's his fault. Where there's a huge difference of being loud in coaching. He's just coaching loud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's different than me, but that would be an example.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned you coached four of your sons and two at the same time. And you are clearly uniquely positioned to offer some thoughts on that experience, why it was so challenging, maybe what you would do differently, or no, actually I handled it really well and this is how you handle those situations. Can you offer a few thoughts in regards to that to other coaches out there that might be in that situation? Personally, I realized that it would be really bad if I continued to coach my daughter who's wired the same way I was, and it was just butting heads. And so I changed roles and let her go have her experience. But I wonder what your thoughts are.
The younger one was the better one. And the older one was already a year of college back off his mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called Coach Meyer, who was at Northern State at the time, because I know he coached his son. And I said, any advice? And he said, coach him like everybody else. But on the way home, you're dead and coaching's done. And he goes, that sounds great. That's not easy to do. Mm-hmm. But he goes, and that's what I tried to do. Mm-hmm. And I think the one son still kind of carries a grudge. He probably did get hosed a little bit because it was tough to play them both out there at the same time.
Yeah.
When you have one parent in the crowd screaming racial things at your two kids. But I think it was a great experience and it was fun to coach all of them. My youngest son that didn't get to play at all, he's probably the best teammate I've ever had on a team. But it was a great experience, but boy, it was hard.
Yeah. Well, the point that Coach Meyer made and that you echoed is, I think, what is the hardest part? I'm coaching the gym or on the field or in whatever role. And once we walk off, like I'm done and I'm now dad. And depending on the age of the people we're working with, it was always hard developmentally at the age my kids were for them to separate. Hey, it's not dad giving me a correction. It's the coach. And that was the thing that really was hard for my kid.
And it might be different than I was in college with them because it could be a diff. If we're in one of those small little towns I coached at, in those little rural communities, it could be tough on the kid.
Yeah.
It'd be much tougher on the kid than it might be you because of other parents and things like that. And we really didn't have to deal with that here.
Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you for sharing that. Do you have, can you point to a time when you were not successful or where you feel like you failed that you've leaned on throughout your coaching career as a reminder that things can get better?
When I went to Columbia and we were 1-12 before Christmas, and I had a kid on my team that played for me in high school who was back off the mission, but now he is 5 inches taller. And he was a stability factor on that team, along with Matt Williams, that I mentioned earlier to you, because we came back after Christmas and we won a couple games and we knocked off the number one team in the state by 25. And then we knocked off the number three team in the state by about 17. We ended up finished fourth in our league. And then we made a run to the playoffs and we got beat by Kenyatta, who had two pros on it. They both played in the NBA. And sticking to how we do things. I remember the one of the third or fourth games of the year we were playing at Merritt. And one of these kids transferred from Merritt the year before. And so he redshirted and now he was playing for me. And he ended up being an all-league player and playing at Metro State when they won a national championship. But at that time, he was 6'9" and wanted to play how he wanted to play. And so I just sat him. And one of his buddies from Oakland, if you've been in Merritt's gym, their gym has a big cement thing right by your bench. And this guy, his name was No Thumbs, because I guess his thumbs had been cut off or something. But he sat up there and just called me MF this and swore at me for 30 minutes. And Jody never went back in. I shouldn't have said his name. Jody Hollins was awesome. He works for the Denver Nuggets now. But after that game, Jody bought in because he knew he wasn't going to play. Because if I'm not going to play him when that guy's kind of a scary dude swearing at me for 30 straight minutes of the game, and you're still not going to put me in, I guess I'm not going to play. So he went from like averaging 2 points a game to being all conference, averaging 19 points a game, 11 rebounds in conference. We started winning when that started happening because Matt Williams averaged 5 a game the year before. And for us, he averaged 25 and 14.
Nice.
So we really got the ball inside and that really helped us out.
The takeaway though, being stay the course.
If you're going to get fired for what you're going to do.
Yeah. No,
say, do it. You've got the job. Do what you want to do.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. This one's a little bit more complicated to answer because it's so open-ended, but I'll throw it out there. If you had to point to something that you've most recently changed your mind on, and it might be basketball related, it might not, but the framing being, this is what I used to believe. And now I'm over here and here's why. What would you say that is?
I'm probably really big on my expectations were high, how I wanted our players to behave. And I remember in high school, one of the best players in our league on another team mooned the whole crowd. So we had to sit out a game. And some teacher asked, well, why don't you guys do that? And because, well, we wouldn't miss a game, we'd just be done. And I'm not saying I may be more lenient, but being a high school coach and now being a junior college coach, you deal with different things. And I was reading something even the other day and it talked about Coach Krzyzewski was talking about rules and standards. And he goes, he didn't have a lot of rules because rules are something you have to punish people when they don't follow. And standards are something you inspire to live up to. And that's just a stupid answer, but raising those standards, I think I'm more worried about standards now and lifting everybody to those standards instead of hammering people. Not that we ever really hammered people, but some people may have thought we did. But instead of having a set pattern of rules now, right now our rules are no complaining, no excuses, no entitlement, be on time. Actually be early. Those are our team rules. And that's about it.
I don't think it's a stupid answer. I think it is
Very thoughtful. And again, a part of that growth and maturity as you figure out what's important to you, what lessons you're trying to instill in your athletes and the human beings that you have been charged with cultivating. And the idea of rules versus standards, or I even use guidelines. Our document is guidelines. And it's, you need the flexibility to deal with the circumstances as they present themselves, because the answer is always, it depends. And this is the consequence 100% of the time. What if the kid got in a car accident and you're texting them like, hey, what's wrong? Why can't you get on time? And the kids obviously had a much more significant circumstance. So I love that. I think the sooner coaches can get to the understanding that the more rules you have, the more you have to, one, enforce them, have consequences, and focus on what matters, and understand that a lot of the mistakes, especially the high school kids are going to make, are age-appropriate mistakes, and our job is to guide them through those and develop an appropriate mistake response. And I think that's a great answer. All right. If you were starting over and you got to start over with all of the knowledge that you've accumulated in your career, what advice would you have for your younger self to get you started and get closer to who you are now earlier?
I think things have really changed a lot in coaching wise, because when I first started, and I was lucky enough to get that D1 thing right off the bat, but back then you were a high school coach, and if you were good, you got on somebody's staff if you had a good player, and it went from there. And now it seems like that doesn't happen anymore, mm-hmm. unless you're Nate Oates, who has a guy and ends up in Alabama. But now it seems like you almost have to work for free, which I did back then. But in just a younger guy, and you just hang around till someone hires you, and then you hang around there. So it's totally changed. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not sure if it's for the better, because they never have an opportunity to be a high school head coach and figure out how to teach kids that aren't good. You have to find a way to win with who you got, because that's who you have. You need mm-hmm. to teach someone how to steal mm-hmm. and how to ball fake and make a pass and those type of things. So I'm really fortunate for the path I took. And I think it helped me be where I am. Like when I left NAU, and I think it had a big impact on me, because I didn't want to put my family in a situation that I didn't feel comfortable with. I didn't want to trust somebody else with my family and my wife and my kids. And I think that's why I've had opportunities to go back D1 and those type of things. But there's just not a lot of guys I would trust, because we had 6 kids during this time period. Now we don't have any at home. They're all, last two are at college. But there wasn't a lot of people I was willing to trust my wife and family to by how they want to do things.
Yeah.
And California junior college jobs are phenomenal jobs compared to other jobs in the country. Mm-hmm. And so we just really focused on what we do and how we can make an impact where we are. And that goes back to Coach Meyer. He always said, you need to read the book by Frosty Westerly and make the big time where you are. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've tried to do the whole time. And the quicker you can really figure that out, instead of trying to climb from here to there, you're just going to be happier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think that's great advice. I think often as we're younger, there's a certain aspect of imposter syndrome we're trying to deal with and wrestle with in our own minds, and do things that aren't necessarily as focused and intentional as we get to later in our career, when we have finally figured out how to be more secure in ourselves and then be able to build that foundation in others. And really think that's a smart way to look at things. Hey, Coach, this is great. Appreciate having you on. Look forward to, you know, getting out to see you guys when we get to the other side of COVID here. And appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it, Justin.
This podcast was also brought to you by ttroops.com. As coaches, our inboxes get flooded with noise on how to make your program better. TeachHoops.com will get you focused on what needs to get done. One thing you've heard from these podcasts is, no matter the experience, you got to keep pushing yourself to be better. Coach Steve Collins will help you direct that noise. He is there to help you. He has the credentials as a coach, and he's never turned down a Teach Hoops member. Sign up for a plan at TeachHoops.com and mention us at checkout. This site is here simply to help you be better. Take advantage and see you on the court. Remember, go to teachhoops.com.
This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It is a delicious, sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. I've been using Element Recharge for the last few months after hearing about it on another podcast, and since then, I've stocked up on boxes and boxes. I usually use it 1 to 2 times per day. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your very best. Plus, it has zero sugar, artificial ingredients, or other junk you simply do not want. Speaking of performance, the best performers in the world use Element. I'm talking about Team USA Weightlifting, NBA teams, NFL teams, and Navy SEALs. The list goes on. Element can expand your limits too. Want more energy while low-carb dieting or intermittent fasting? Want to crush that next workout? Or want to just be ready for the next workday? Element has the electrolytes to make this happen. And with 8 delicious flavors, you're guaranteed to find one that will satisfy your taste buds. They just released their latest flavor, grapefruit, and it has quickly become one of my favorites. Element came up with a fantastic offer for us. Just go to drinkelement.com/JustinClimo to claim your 8-count free sample pack.
Thanks for listening. If you found this valuable, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and give contacts and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support.